You to grab a Bible, whether you do that on an electronic device or one in the chair racks. We are continuing a series in the book of Hebrews. Today we're looking at Hebrews chapter 9, verses 13 to 28. In those chair Bibles, today's text is found on page 842. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 13 to 28 is what we're looking at, and it's found on page 842. It'll also be up on the screen, and you're welcome to follow along there. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 13 to 28. The blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of the heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean sanctify them so that they are outwardly clean. How much more, then, will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death, so that we may serve the living God. For this reason, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant, that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. Now that he has died as a ransom to set them free from the sins committed under the first covenant. In the case of a will, it is necessary to prove the death of the one who made it, because the will is in force only when someone has died. It never takes effect while the one who made it is living. This is why even the first covenant was not put into effect without blood. When Moses had proclaimed every command of the law to all of the people, he took blood of calves together with water, scarlet, wool, and branches of hyssop, and he sprinkled the scroll and all of the people. He said, "This is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you to keep." And in the same way, he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and everything used in the ceremonies. In fact, the law requires that nearly everything be cleansed with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. It was necessary, then, for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these sacrifices, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a sanctuary made with human hands that was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself, now to appear for us in God's presence. Nor did he enter heaven to offer himself again and again, the way the high priest enters the most holy place every year with blood that is not his own. Otherwise, Christ would have had to suffer many times since the creation of the world. But he has appeared once for all at the culmination of the ages to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Just as people are destined to die once and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many. And he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. The word of the Lord. Blood is mentioned in this text that we just read 9 times. 9 times. In a lot of cultures, blood is sort of addressed. It's paid attention to. It's out there. Many cultures still today use blood in their worship, in their everyday lives. It's a part of the thing that is taking place. It's seen. It's used. Animal sacrifice is practiced in much of the world still today. But in our culture, issues of blood are really kept away. They're not seen. They're not even observed. Many of us see very little blood ever. And the whole idea is that there's this big difference in the way blood is perceived. As a matter of fact, even people in our culture today will call Christianity and other religions that bloody God, that as though there's this just absolute sort of terrible mark against religion because it is focusing on and looking at blood. Additionally, when we look at that and we see that that culture and many cultures of the world today see blood in a very different light than we do, but they look at morality much different than we do as well. Our cultural morality teaches that tolerance is right and exclusivity is wrong. That free choice is right and that restrictions are wrong. That helping others is right, that harming even animals is wrong and forbidden. So how does this text then, being so different in that culture and many cultures of the day, How does it address our culture today that is so different? How does it speak to what's going on in our lives? Well, it's interesting that another common word then in the text that we wouldn't necessarily make a natural association with in our broader culture, the other word that appears here four times is clean by various forms. So the issue of blood and cleansing is what this text is about. And we who have read the Bible a bit, we understand that, but think about it from the cultural context, that the general culture doesn't really see blood as a cleansing means and way. How does that come about? And so it causes us to ask the question, do I need cleansing? I mean, that culture, maybe in other cultures, maybe other people, they need it, but do I need cleansing? And if so, how do I get cleansed? And then what does that really mean? Why are we to be cleansed? When we look at life and we watch what's going on around us, we find that the issues of regret, the issues of shame, of guilt, of hurt and doubt, they're all around us. How do we deal with those? What's the answer that we would give to someone who's dealing with horrible shame, awful guilt? What do we bring as a cleansing answer? Here is the Christian response. First then, look at, do I need cleansing? Shame really is prevalent. What's the difference between guilt and shame? Shame generally is the idea that we think I am bad. That's what shame is. Guilt is that I have done bad. I have performed bad. I have done something wrong. That's what guilt is to do. Shame is that I am bad. And the issue is, and the weird thing that goes on in our culture, is that there's a lot of shame that's sort of out there floating around in our culture. But interestingly enough, and so confusing, is that guilt isn't a big deal in our culture. People will explain away guilt. They will, with a relative morality, they will say, well, that's not really that bad. Or, you know, that isn't any big deal. You shouldn't worry about that. You shouldn't, they will say many times, well, you're imposing your morality on me. You shouldn't do that. You're making me feel guilty. So in the one sense, we sort of denigrate or push away or pretend like there isn't guilt. Meanwhile, shame is incredibly high in our culture. It doesn't make sense, but it is what's happening. How does that happen? How do we see that shame really is there? Well, we look at it with high suicide rates. We see it with the idea of drug abuse, with all kinds of ways of trying to suppress what's going on deep inside it. Is that all of drug abuse and prescription drug abuse and those kind of things? No, but certainly it's a prevalent root cause. We're trying to numb the pain of shame. If people really understood what's going on there, and when we look at that, we have to step back and say, why is that the case? Well, let's recognize that we're part of the problem. For instance, I don't know if you've ever really thought about, well, how scary it would be if somebody could read your mind. I tell you, you don't want to know my thoughts. You know, to think about the idea of what goes on in my brain, and I really don't think that I'm alone. If people really knew my thoughts, what would they think of me? You see, we cover up. We're not really at rest. And that's also true of the letter's recipients here. They were going about the religious duty, even the religious duties that God had given them, but over and again, they had to keep going, and it didn't satisfy. Look at what verse 13 says. It says there that the blood of goats and these ceremony things, they came, and they were taking the unclean, and they would sanctify them. And then what's a key word there? They would sanctify them outwardly. They were outwardly clean. Do you see that? And that's why they had to keep going back again, because it didn't deal with the internals. It didn't get all the way to the core, the heart issue. Verse 23 also says it. It was necessary then for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these sacrifices. In other words, it had to be done again and again. They were pointing somewhere else. It was a copy of what is to come, down at verse 25. And again, the way the high priests had to go, they had to enter in. And it was an annual reminder. It was a daily reminder. It was a weekly reminder that I haven't dealt with the core problem. It's still going on in here. It's still going on in my heart as well. I'm still facing this. And so the repetition, the continued emphasis there brought about the idea of guilt and continued to remind us of it. So how do we deal with guilt? Again, in our culture, relativism's answer is that, you know, you really just shouldn't make me feel guilty. In other words, it's really okay if I sleep with my girlfriend. It's not that big of a deal. Why are you making that to be something that's so passé or old or whatever? And we would say we redefine the moral standard. But the problem with that is what we're doing is we're trying to push away the guilt, but we all end up feeling, or we find this sense of shame. So does it really work? You see, relativism doesn't work, because what happens when I decide in my relativistic approach to morality and not wanting to feel guilty that I think that murder and rampage and theft is okay? Why would you impose your morality on me? You see, it ends up in a total disintegration of culture. It won't work. Guilt, by definition, means that there's a standard. And we all know there has to be a standard, or we can't even exist. And so guilt ends up having to be addressed. It, though, when addressed, says that there is a purpose to life. There is a reason to love. There is an absolute that I'm here for, that I'm to be accomplishing, that I'm to be living for and in. It gives me then a responsibility and a joyful and delightful one. That's what all comes about when we hold on to a moral standard. But we have to recognize that the world out there is bad, and it is because I'm in it. I'm the problem. It's what's also in me. I need cleansing. I want to give you several stories today from a book, Through the Valley of the Kwai. It's written by Ernest Gordon. The movie also, To End All Wars, and we're going to see a clip of that, is based on the book. Gordon was a prisoner for 3.5 years. He writes an autobiographical account of World War II, British soldiers. I know it's not a very good picture, but that's the pictures of the men who managed to survive in these horrible camps in the River Kwai. He was interned there for 3.5 years in these Japanese prisoner of war camps, and he saw horrific starvation, sickness, oppression, violence, suffering, death by these Japanese guards. He saw people tied up by their thumbs, buried alive, bayoneted, shot, drowned, decapitated, even crucified. That was some of the tortures that went on. Many prisoners facing these horrors in the midst of these camps ended up becoming full of despair. Others, incredibly fearful. Many of them became extremely selfish. In other words, it was such a scrape and scratch to try and survive at all that they became incredibly self-centered and even made their fellow prisoners their enemies. They ended up cursing not only the Japanese, they cursed each other and God. But some, in the midst of those camps, and in the midst of this one camp that Gordon was in particular, were believers and realized that their approach and what was happening in themselves wasn't working. Soon they discovered that those responses were no solution, and really what they found themselves realizing was that I'm being as bad as the Japanese when I want to hate those captors and kill them. And they confronted that absolute morality then, realizing that, and they found cleansing was necessary. You see, we can always look at people and we can find them worse than us. We can look around and find some people who are performing worse and then justify. And all we're doing is moving that relative line of morality. That's exactly what we're doing. And war crimes are full of that sort of self-justification. And when we justify sex apart from marriage, use of pornography, wanton divorce, greed, gossip, gluttony, we're in the very same continuum. It's what we're doing. We're defining our own standards, and it won't deal with the guilt. We can go back again and again and keep trying to deal with that guilt, keep trying to make the sacrifices, keep trying to say we're going to do better, keep doing the things that go in our sanctuary, in our place of works, and it won't satisfy any more than it didn't for them. I need cleansing. I am the problem. So then we move on to point two. How do I get cleansed? What do we do? Now, it was interesting, you know, that most of you know anyway, a few weeks ago I helped led a father and son trip out in Colorado. And one of the boys decided, since this was a man's week, that he didn't want to take a shower. He thought it'd be really cool to go a whole week without a shower. Well, first day, we go out and do some hiking. It was pretty hot weather, and the other people decided to mock snicks that idea right away. Like, no, I think you're going to take a shower. You're gonna have a shower. And the idea was he didn't really want to be clean, but we say, no, you need to be cleaned. I'm glad that he listened, and he did that. But notice what verse 22 tells us about how do we get cleansed. It says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. We step back from that and ask ourselves wisely, why? Why, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness? There's no cleansing. What's the reason? Now, we could unpack that for a very long time, but what we see come out here is because forgiveness is costly. That's why blood. Forgiveness is costly. See, wrong is costly. If you have forgiven, you know the cost. I mean, picture with me in your mind's eye. Maybe you've recently incurred the pain of being mistreated or being wronged or being harmed. Or if that doesn't really get visceral for you, think about what you would imagine in your mind's eye as the very worst treatment that you could endure, that you could go through. And then what would you do? What would you have to go through in order to forgive that person who had wronged you so horribly? You see, if I seek retribution, if I harbor anger, malice, and cruelty in my heart, then what I really am doing, I want that other person to suffer for what they've done to me, but additional suffering, does it really help? Is it a solution? See, either they pay or I pay. When someone wrongs me, either they pay or I pay. And if I make them, if I force them to pay, then in fact, both of us pay because I now have to deal with the bitterness in my own heart. I now have to deal with the reality that I have also been involved in the sin. See, forgiveness costs me. That's why blood. Because the redemptive power of self-sacrifice. That's what we're being told in this passage. That these sacrifices that were made over and over again, they pointed to one ultimate reality of sacrifice that was going to be one and done. Gordon, in his experience again in the prisoner of war camps and through the Valley of the Kwai, he tells an incredible story. Gordon, here's a picture of him. He was 6'3" and he got all the way down to 100 pounds. But amazingly, there was a point at which when someone finally got sick and they couldn't work anymore, they were starving them to death, they put them into a death den. There was some other name for it. But there was a place where it was a one-way trip. You went over there and you really got reduced rations then. Amazingly enough, there were two Christians who came into that tent and began sharing their starvation rations with him and nursed him back to health. That was the beginning of his conversion to Christ. It was an unheard of sacrifice in the midst of horror. And they continued to have this sort of impact in the camp, sharing and making a difference of incredible sacrifice among their prisoners who were becoming more and more selfish. One day, they had been out on work detail, and they had been shoveling and working, and at the end of the day, they gathered together and they formed up and they were to check in their tools, and in the tool check, there was a shovel missing. And the guard immediately demanded that whoever hid the shovel would get it and get it in right now. And he went into a froth and a fury and an anger. And he said, who took the shovel? Someone step forward, find that shovel, put it in here and do that. And he kept going and he worked himself all up into a lather. And finally he said, all die, all die. And he pulled up his weapon and he was going to begin to shoot every one of them because nobody stepped forward. Finally, one of these Christians stepped forward, said that he took the shovel. The guard had worked himself all into a lather and he literally beat him to death right there in front of them. They turned and they marched into the camp. And when they got into the camp at the next tool check, they found that there was no shovel missing. It was simply a miscount. That man gave his life that all of those others would continue to live, even in the midst of the worst that humanity could dish out? Does it cost this redemptive sacrifice that we sing about? Does that kind of sacrifice in that camp inspire us? Cleansing is costly, and Jesus paid the price. You see, the failure of the first covenant pointed to the costly completion, and that's what we're told over and over. And I want to highlight it for you as you look at that and you read the passage. Let me unpack it for you, making the contrast that this gives. Here we have them. First, we find in the old covenant that there is, go ahead, Aaron, repeated sacrifice, but this is a one sacrifice, and it's not just one, but it's a one and eternal. Then we see that it's not only the blood here of others, but this is his own blood. He came and gave it. That's the contrast we're told. We're being told how costly it is. Again, we see that there's a covering for sin here. In other words, there's this surface put over it like we do when we try and say that things are not that bad or I didn't perform that bad, but no, he is putting away of sin. He is absolutely removing it. We were told that this was for Israel. They had to come and practice all of these things. And he's saying, no, now this one is for all sinners. And here we find that it's also that they left the Holy of Holies. The priest went in and he practiced and he did the thing and then he left and he came out. But not Jesus. He completed. It's once and done. He remains in heaven. He is seated there with an absolute and complete finished work. The priest came out to bless the people, but we still wait this day that he will come and he will take his people to heaven, that they too would know the absolute great cost that has been paid and that we will be able to be taken and welcomed with him into heaven. That's the cost that was paid. That's the sacrifice that is given. And in verse 14, we're told that his sacrifice can, catch this, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death, even to your thought, in other words. No more guilt. No more shame. No more harboring that anger. No more hanging on to those chains, even to your conscience, because he gave such a great sacrifice. You see, when we downgrade guilt, when we rationalize, when we express that we are not as bad as someone else, what we're doing is we're seeking some way to surface over the top of the guilt and the shame and the sin. Jesus said, don't do that. It has to be going all the way to the depths of your every thought. I sometimes ask people if they are a Christian and they say something like, I'm trying. If you say that you are trying to be a Christian, then you don't understand Christianity. You don't know what it's about. You are missing it. You are misunderstanding by very central point what Christianity is about. Trying is not Christianity. A new standing before God is what makes us a Christian. And it's only by the work of Christ, not by my trying. Cleansed by his sacrifice. He declared us clean by the sacrifice of Christ. If we try to deal with our guilt by our good works, by appeasing God, we're doing the exact same thing. We in our culture are going back into that altar. We might not be actually using a lamb, but we're trying to offer to God our good works, and it's just as unsolvable and doesn't work as it didn't work for them. We sometimes do good to manipulate God. We've done good, God. Why have you let this happen or why have you let that happen? We want to get him and manipulate him into healing. That's religion. See, in a world of pain, he took it upon himself and he did so to cleanse our conscience so that today you could let go of your guilt. You could let go of that pain. You could let go of that need to bring retribution to that person who has harmed you so horribly, and you could receive today Christ's sacrifice, whether for the first time or again and again and again. Don't carry that shame. Sometimes the hardest person to forgive is ourselves. Let it go. Let him cleanse you to the very thought in your mind. Receive it freely. But then we get to move on. How do I get cleansed? We also get to see why. Why did God do this? Why does he do this very thing? God transforms us, not for ourselves. That's what got us into this mess. You see, when I make me the center, that's when we end up having this weird and shifting morality that doesn't work. And so the idea is, why are we saved? It has to be something outside of myself, because when it's self, it brings us to that point of destruction. Look at verses 27 and 28. Just as people are destined to die once and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many. And he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are, I want you to say those next words with me. Say them, will you? For those who are waiting for him. It isn't sitting in your chair waiting. That's not what the word means. It means in this loving anticipation, I can't believe it. I get to be with Jesus. He's coming back for me, and I'm going to give everything for him. It's a waiting of engagement, of expectation, of saying, I have found the purpose and the point of life. You see, he is our reward. We can look to glorify him in any circumstance that we face now, no matter how horrid. We have a purpose and a point in the midst of it. No matter what life points at us or throws at us, in the midst of that, we understand the central point of life and it can never, ever be taken away. He is the point of life, no longer me. And so we find that he is then cleansing us so that we would serve, verse 14, that living God. Cleanse us so that we may serve the living God, cleansed for a purpose. You see, true transformation radically transforms us. It changes us. It empowers us to love, to serve, and to give. We now long for him and to honor him, not for our own objectives. So let me go to the movie now to end all wars. The movie is based on the book Through the Valley of the Kwai, and in the midst of the very worst of humanity that they could dish out, some men found incredible freedom and purpose even there. They knew hope in utterly despairing circumstances. What could give that kind of answer? Let me tell you about the two principal factions in the midst of that camp. One was led by a man named Major Campbell. He hates the Japanese. He wants to escape or to kill his captors, and he hates his other prisoners who are not willing to side with him and bring about a rebellion. Dusty is a Christian who has made such a difference in the camp, including nursing Gordon back to life. Major Campbell has been horrible to Dusty. He has treated him awful in this ongoing struggle in the midst of the camp of these two power things, even within the prisoners. Campbell has tried with others to make an escape, but he was caught. He is brought back and he is paraded in front of all the prisoners, and he's going to be executed as an example of what happens to those who seek to escape. Watch in the scene what Dusty does for, and remember this, his enemy. Major Campbell, who has mistreated him so horribly, is the one to be executed. And watch what Dusty does. Stepping out of the ranks even is forbidden. The commandant, having seen a picture of Christ on a cross, hated Dusty and his weak Christian belief. And he also knew that Major Campbell hated him. The commandant knew that. But watch his astonishment at this Japanese commandant.
Ito.
Dusty. You saying? What you saying?
No, no.
I've paused the scene there because taking him outside the gate, incredible Christian image, he suddenly realizes that he's not going to have the mercy of a sword across the neck. But having seen that he worshiped a Lord who was crucified, he's about to crucify him. I've cut the most brutal part of the scene, but I want you to watch this Japanese commandant who now, seeing in the face of someone his worst enemy, who to his other enemy has volunteered himself and now says to the commandant, even seeing that he's going to die by crucifixion, do it. Do it. Watch what happens. Second Corinthians 5:14-15 says, "For Christ's love compels us. Because we are convinced that one died for all, and therefore all died, and he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again." See, cleansing and forgiveness is oh so costly to God. And when we try and pay it ourselves, we insult him as though we could do it ourselves. And he's offered that payment that you might have a transforming that is so deep that you could give your life in the midst of the very worst circumstances that all of life can dish out. If Christ's sacrifice can empower men in the midst of those places to serve and to give even their life for their own enemy, what can't he do in you? What self-sacrifice can he empower you to do joyfully that his name might be honored? Are you carrying guilt, shame, regret? Is something weighing you down this day that needs the cleansing work of Christ's blood? We all need cleansing. That shame, that guilt, those thoughts, Christ died for those. Don't carry them any longer. Don't hang on to them. Don't keep going back to them. Don't be rechained. You can be free, not by continuing to justify yourself as though we're not that bad, but by recognizing the depth and the absolute move and work of what Christ has done. That gift sets us free then to serve, to sacrifice, to love even those who hate us. Be cleansed. Let's pray. Father, thank you that the cost was so great to you that it helps us to see how willing you are to cleanse us from every sin, even to the degree of our thought and our conscience. And to give us a new heart that we would have a purpose and a hope, not trying to excuse how bad we are, but rather to know that greater is the sacrifice than the level of our sin. Would we rejoice in that this day? Would the transforming of our heart be so radical that moment by moment, day by day, we can let go of those things that have hurt us, those people who have harmed us, and that we would know the peace of Christ that surpasses all comprehension, that will guard our hearts and minds in you, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.